Okay, let's resume our workshop. Now we have Professor Ho Ho Klai from the University of Singapore. The title of his presentation is "Should We Be Convicting Persons We Don't Believe to Be Guilty?" Thank you for being here, Professor. It's your turn.
Right. So I've chosen as the topic of my paper a very narrow question. Should we be convicting people we don't believe to be guilty? I think there are reasons to think that we shouldn't convict people we don't believe to be guilty, as probably most of us would intuitively. But the difficulty lies in articulating clearly what those reasons might be. One might think that, following the line of the Eggers talk, to convict someone of an offence is, among other things, to assert that the person has committed that offence. And one shouldn't be asserting that the person has committed the offence if one doesn't know that. On the standard view, belief is necessary for knowledge. Hence, it's wrong to convict people we don't believe to be guilty. But surely there's more that is wrong with this than just a breach of a rule of assertion. So in this paper, I propose a different line of thought. If a judge convicts the accused person without judging that one would be justified in believing that he or she is guilty, the judge's motivating reason for the conviction is inadequate. It is objectionable to convict people for inadequate reasons. But the problem is that the law exceptionally permits or even compels judges to convict people when they don't believe that they are guilty. This is considered problematic and in need of special justification, and rightly so, because I think it compromises the rule of law. My argument rests on the distinction between two kinds of legal rules. And in making this distinction, I will draw on, but I will not adhere strictly to the works of James Fitzjames Stevens and Maya Dan Cohen. Stevens sought to situate the law of evidence in the broader scheme of legal rules. He distinguishes and notes the relationship between rules of substantive law and rules of procedural law. According to him, every judicial proceeding has for its purpose the ascertaining of some legal right or liability, and such rights or liabilities are dependent upon and arise out of facts. Two things are required of the law under this scheme. The first is to provide for the legal effect of particular classes of facts in establishing rights and liabilities, and this is the province of substantive law. The second is to set up a course of procedure by which persons interested may apply the substantive law to particular cases, and this, according to him, is a job of procedural law. And a subset of that is the law of evidence. The law of evidence determines how the parties are to convince the court of the existence of that state of facts, which, according to the provisions of substantive law, would establish the existence of the right or liability which they allege to exist. So that's Stephen. Dan Cohen distinguishes between conduct rules and decision rules. These two types of rules differ in that they serve different purposes, and the norms they create are directed at different actors and acts. Conduct rules are addressed to the general public, and this is for the purpose of guiding the behavior of its members. Examples are rules against theft, robbery, drug trafficking, and so forth. Decision rules, on the other hand, are addressed to officials, telling them how they are to make decisions in the exercise of powers over the general public. Rules of evidence law are decision rules. The judge or jury must reach a decision on the verdict in accordance with, among other things, rules of evidence. For Dan Cohen, a rule can be a conduct rule, a decision rule, or both. On the last possibility, he considers statutes defining offences to be decision rules as well as conduct rules, because they do not just guide the behaviour of the general public. They also, according to him, specify for the courts some of the preconditions to the imposition of punishment. Dan Cohen's distinction between conduct rules and decision rules does not map exactly onto Stevens' distinction between substantive rules and procedural rules. Some rules that Stephen would view as substantive criminal law, such as the rule providing for the defences of duress and necessity, are treated as decision rules by Dan Cohen. For Dan Cohen, defences such as duress and necessity are not meant to guide the behaviour of members of the general public in the sense of guiding the decision whether to commit a crime. They are instead rules based on some considerations of fairness or compassion that apply after the event to guide officials in deciding on conviction and punishment. For Stephen, on the other hand, these defences are part of substantive law in that they set out the legal effect of duress or necessity on criminal liability. The broad insight I want to draw from the separate works is the divide and connections between legal rules that are norms of criminal liability and legal rules that are norms of decision-making. Norms of criminal liability are roughly what Dan Cohen calls conduct rules. However, he writes as if conduct rules are addressed to members of the general public, whereas decision rules are addressed only to officials. But conduct rules may also apply and apply only to officials. An example would be the rule of criminal law that forbids public servants from accepting gratifications in respect of an official act. Norms of criminal liability may be found in rules defining offences as well as rules defining defences. And to avoid unnecessary complications, I will assume away any complications that might arise from criminal defences. My focus will be on rules that define offences, and I will refer to them as offence rules. And I will refer to the norm subjects as citizens. By norms of decision-making, I mean specifically the norms that guide officials in applying norms of criminal liability to citizens, and even more specifically, in the subset of such norms that consists of rules that guide judges and juries on fact-finding and verdict deliberation. I will refer to them as decision rules. While it is true that we would expect judges and juries to apply the relevant offence rule in determining the verdict, for my purposes, and unlike Dan Cohen, I do not treat the offence rule as itself a decision rule. Judges and juries are the norm subjects of decision rules, whereas the accused person is the norm subject of the offence rule in question. While the judge or jury must follow the decision rules in reaching the verdict, the offence rule is something that they apply to the accused person in determining his or her guilt. For ease of reference, I refer to judge or jury simply as a judge. For a closer look at offence rules and their functions, let me give the example of the offence of drug trafficking. This is a very common rule of substantive law that can be found in most, if not all, legal systems today. The rule defines drug trafficking, makes it a crime, and forbids citizens from engaging in it. This offence rule is invariably accompanied by a punishment rule that spells out the punishment for drug trafficking. But punishment rules are conceptually distinct from offence rules, and my focus is on the offence rule. The offence rule against drug trafficking is addressed to citizens and provides them with an authoritative normative reason not to do the act which the law has defined as drug trafficking. While most, if not all, legal systems have such a rule, the way it is formulated is, of course, jurisdiction specific. So let me just assume that under the relevant offence rule of a particular jurisdiction, a person commits that offence if and only if A, the person possesses a controlled drug, B, while having knowledge of its nature, and C, the possession was for the purpose of trafficking. Given that all three elements are necessary to constitute the offence of drug trafficking, the accused has not committed the offence of drug trafficking if A, the person was not in possession of the substance, or was in possession but did not know what it was, or was in possession, knew what it was, but had no intention of trafficking in it. The three elements of the offence definitions are types of facts, or as Stephen puts it, classes of facts that constitute the offence of drug trafficking. These fact types are open to different factual instantiations. The instantiations of the types of facts that constitute a crime in a particular case, as we might say tokens of the fact types, have been given different legal names, and I'll stick to one. I'll call these facts material facts. The criminal charge must be drafted with sufficient particularity to give the accused fair notice of the material facts. What the judge must determine at a trial is not whether the accused is guilty of drug trafficking, but whether the accused is guilty of the offence as charged. That is to say, guilty of the instance of drug trafficking as particularized in the charge. And I will use the term charged offence to refer to the offence cited and particularized in the charge. So while the discussion that follows will, for the ease of exposition, refer to the fact types in the offence definition, to be precise, the dispute at a trial is over at least some of the material facts. As already noted, offence rules provide authoritative normative reasons to guide the conduct of citizens. The rule against drug trafficking gives citizens an authoritative normative reason to refrain from that kind of act. Offence rules have another function. They guide judges as well. Offence rules authoritatively set out the normative reasons only for which judges may convict citizens of the relevant offences. And I shall sidestep the objectivism versus perspectivism debate by simply adopting the objectivist view. And on the objectivist view, normative reasons are facts. They are independent of the agent's belief. In our example, the normative reason provided in the offence rule for the judge to convict a person of drug trafficking is the following set of facts. A, person was in possession of controlled drug. B, while knowing what it was. And C, the possession was for the purpose of trafficking. So long as one of these three elements does not obtain in the case at hand, there will be insufficient normative reason for a guilty verdict. This is because the accused person has not committed the offence of drug trafficking and as such does not deserve to be convicted of that offence. Now let me turn to the decision rules. Where a person is put on trial for violating an offence rule, the judge typically has only two options on the outcome: either convict or acquit. And the judge must decide between these two options in accordance with the applicable decision rules. The applicable decision rules include a set of three verdict rules. There are, as we shall see, decision rules other than verdict rules. Two of the verdict rules may be stated as follows, and I've laid it out in the handout. VR1, the first verdict rule, the judge must convict the accused person of the charged offence if the guilt of that person for that offence is proved, and correspondingly, the judge must acquit if the guilt is disproved. Two clarifications are in order. First, it might be said that criminal guilt is a legal construct, and this is reference to the earlier discussion this morning. No one is guilty unless declared by the court to be guilty, because the guilty verdict, amongst other things, also declares guilt, make it official that the person is guilty. So while it is possible to take the view that guilt is a legal construct, as I use the term in this paper, guilt is factual and independent of proof in court. I would treat it as possible for a person to be in fact guilty and for the prosecution to be unable to prove that the person is in fact guilty. Secondly, my discussion is set primarily in the context of an adversarial system at common law. And in an adversarial system, the parties are in the driving seat. They have control over the scope of the dispute and the production of evidence at the trial. That's their responsibility. Either one or the other of the parties is assigned the burden of proving the disputed material facts. The verdict rules presuppose that there is a dispute, first on whether the accused person is guilty, and a dispute on at least one of the material facts. There may be no dispute on whether the accused is guilty as charged. The accused may plead guilty, in which case there's no need for the prosecution to prove his guilt or her guilt. But suppose the accused person pleads not guilty. The dispute may be limited to only some of the material facts. For example, in a charge of drug trafficking, the accused may admit to having possession of the substance, element A, but deny knowledge that the substance was a controlled drug, element B. If a material fact is not disputed by the accused person, in this example, possession, the prosecution need not prove that fact. The verdict rules are addressed to the judge. They guide the judge in deciding whether to convict or acquit by providing the judge with authoritative reasons for convicting or acquitting the person. Where a judge follows the first verdict rule, VR1, in convicting an accused person of drug trafficking, his or her motivating reason for convicting the person of that offense is the fact that the person's guilt for that offense has been proved. And where a judge follows VR2 in acquitting an accused person of drug trafficking, his or her motivating reason for acquitting the person is the fact that the person's guilt for that offense has been disproved. Now, if the concept of proof employed in the verdict rules is to be construed in terms of knowledge, and if verdict deliberation is a search by the judge for epistemic justification in the resources to which he or she has access, it seems natural to take an internalist view of knowledge. And on a standard internalist account of knowledge, one knows P only if one believes that P, one is justified in believing that P, and P is true. There is consensus that these three conditions are insufficient, but no one really knows what else needs to be satisfied. The point to note is that on the standard analysis, knowledge requires justified belief. And there's general agreement that the belief that's needed for knowledge is the outright kind as opposed to partial belief or credence. So on both the justified belief account and the knowledge account of legal proof, proof of P in the legal context requires justified outright belief in P. Why shouldn't justified belief be enough? What good is there to be had by insisting more strongly on knowledge? If the judge believes justifiably that the accused is guilty as charged, but the accused is in fact innocent, the judge's belief is false. The judge has made an error, even though the person may be blameless for the error. So truth matters on the belief account. But suppose the judge believes justifiably on the evidence that the accused is guilty, and it is true that the accused is guilty. Now, surely that's all that we should ask for. Should it matter in law that the belief was true by luck and therefore doesn't count as knowledge? I cannot see why it should matter. I may be wrong, but I cannot see why it should matter. Now, on a simplistic construction of proof in criminal cases, and what I've set up is more or less a straw man, guilt for the charged offence is proved if and only if, there's a typo in the handout, if and only if the judge believes justifiably or knows that the accused is guilty of the offence. And correspondingly, guilt for the charged offence is disproved if and only if the judge believes justifiably or know that the accused is not guilty of the offence. I think it would be fairly clear why this is simplistic. There are some well-known objections to this simplistic construction of proof, and let me just highlight three of them. First, the decision on the verdict and the act that follows it, conviction or acquittal, are matters for which the judge is responsible. But if proof of guilt turns on the judge's belief, and if dogmatic involuntarism is true, as many believe it to be, the judge cannot be held responsible for the verdict, since the judge has no control over his or her belief in the accuser's guilt. But we do hold the judge epistemically responsible for the verdict. So proof for the purposes of the verdict rules is not based on belief. So that's the first objection. The second objection rests on the view that belief is non-contextual. At common law, as we discussed this morning, there are two standards of proof. Where legal burden is carried by a party in a civil case or by an accused person in a criminal case, the standard of proof must be satisfied on the balance of probabilities, also called preponderance of evidence or preponderance of probabilities. The standard of proof applicable to the prosecution in criminal cases is supposedly the higher one of proof beyond reasonable doubt. It is, as we noted this morning, it is possible for the same set of evidence to be sufficient to prove a fact on the lower standard, balance of probabilities, but not on the higher standard, beyond reasonable doubt. But we cannot say the same of belief. Either the evidence that we have justifies the belief that P, or it does not. It matters not whether the question whether P arises in the context of a civil case or the context of a criminal case, or whether it is the prosecution or the accused person who is alleging that P. Hence, legal proof cannot be a matter of belief. So that's the second objection. The third objection is related to the second one. A person cannot rationally believe at the same time, on the same set of evidence, both P and not P. The judge, unless irrational, cannot at the same time and on the same set of evidence believe in the person's official role that the accused is guilty and believe in some other capacity or for some other purposes that the accused is not guilty and vice versa. The judge either believes one or the other, or neither. So holding this in mind, we can see how, supposedly, the judge may be expected to officially decide and act contrary to his or her private belief regarding the accuser's guilt. And Professor Lecky offers this hypothetical, and Edgar referred to it this morning, but I've set it up in full in the handout that you have. It's a very lengthy hypothetical. But I think Edgar has already summarized it. Essentially, Raymond was raised by racist parents and has, since young, accumulated certain racist beliefs, but as he attends local community college and so forth, he began to recognize some of the causes and consequences of racism and so forth. And Raymond was called to serve on a jury, and after hearing all the evidence, he's able to recognize that the evidence clearly supports the conclusion that the defendant committed a crime. In spite of this, he can't shake the feeling in his gut that the man is innocent. Upon further reflection, Raymond begins to suspect that such a feeling is grounded in the racism that he still harbors. And he concludes that even if he can't quite come to outright believe that the person is guilty, he nevertheless has an obligation to follow the evidence, not his gut. So that's not my hypothetical, that's Professor Lecky's hypothetical. Unless Raymond is irrational, and we are of course assuming that he's not, Raymond cannot at the same time, on the same evidence, believe for the official purpose of deciding the verdict that the accused is guilty and believe privately in his gut that the accused is not guilty. It must be then, so the argument goes, that what is happening in this hypothetical is that Raymond does believe that the accused is not guilty and is voting for a guilty verdict against his belief, as he rightly should. So that's Professor Lecky's argument. So those are three objections to grounding verdict on belief. And since belief is necessary for knowledge, if the above objections to construing proof in terms of belief are sound, the knowledge account must also be rejected. However, the three objections are problematic. The first objection, that we have no direct control over what we believe, is beside the point. Judging whether something is true is a phenomenon that all of us are familiar with. By judging that P, I mean roughly making up one's mind that P is true for the reason that one finds sufficient evidence to support the truth of P. Admittedly, the mental state, whether it be the belief that P or the dogmatic acceptance of P, arises involuntarily from judging that P. Even so, there's agency in the judgment that brought forth the mental state, and the judge is responsible and open to rational criticisms for that judgment. It does not follow from the involuntariness of the mental state that we cannot hold the judge epistemically responsible for his or her judgment. The second objection is not easy to overcome. One response to the second objection is to simply confine an epistemic construction of proof to proof of guilt or proof beyond reasonable doubt, and remain agnostic on the meaning of proof on the balance of probabilities. That's an easy way out, a convenient way out. Another response is to confront the second objection and deny that belief is non-contextual and take the position that epistemic is relative to the interest at stake. And that, of course, is a big thesis and falls out of the scope of this paper. The third objection loses much of its force if we follow Professor Keith Lehrer in distinguishing belief between belief as a first-order dogmatic state and acceptance as a meta-mental state, ordinarily based on positive evaluation of belief. And for Lehrer, knowledge requires epistemic acceptance and not mere belief. While acceptance has often been offered as an alternative to belief in important literature on legal fact-finding, it is taken to mean or encompass pragmatic or practical acceptance. Cohen gives this definition, and he thinks this definition of acceptance is an apt description of what is going on in the judge's mind when the judge is deliberating on the verdict. According to Cohen, to accept that P is to treat it as given that P. It is to have or adopt a policy of deeming, positing, or postulating that P, that is of going along with the proposition in one's mind as a premise or license for inference. We can deem, proceed, or postulate that P for all sorts of purposes, without believing that P. That's obvious. If deeming, positing, or postulating that P is to accept that P, then the acceptance is not epistemic, or at least not necessarily epistemic. And it's clearly not acceptance in Lehrer's sense of acceptance. Lehrer acknowledges that acceptance is an attitude defined in terms of some purpose, and the purpose can be of the practical sort. But according to him, the acceptance that's required for knowledge is acceptance for the epistemic purpose of attaining truth and avoiding error with respect to the very thing that one accepts. It is to accept a P if and only if P. Now, of course, his theory, as with everything else in philosophy, is controversial. And it is a puzzle to me what sort of mental state epistemic acceptance is and how it is, if it is at all different from reflective belief. Indeed, acceptance aimed at truth is so close to belief that Professor Lehrer, in his book, uses the term interchangeably when he thinks precision is not needed. Anyway, we may agree with the premise of the second objection to this extent. We cannot at the same time rationally believe both P and not P. In Lecky's hypothetical, Raymond's example, we are told that he is able to recognize that the evidence clearly supports the conclusion that the defendant committed the crime of which he is accused. Now, given this, it is not obvious to me that it is right to assume that Raymond does not believe that the defendant is guilty. But even if we concede this point to Professor Lecky, the hypothetical is not fatal to an epistemic account of legal proof. The belief that P may arise against one's better judgment. And maybe it is possible to believe that P, while rationally, maybe it's possible to believe that P while rationally accepting in the epistemic sense that not P. I think Professor Lehrer would see it this way. As he would see it, Raymond accepts in the sense necessary for knowledge that the defendant is guilty, even though he can't help believing that he's not guilty. So even if we concede that legal proof does not rest on belief, it is still possible to maintain some sort of epistemic construction of legal proof by basing it on epistemic acceptance. Nevertheless, the second objection does raise a real difficulty for the simplistic epistemic account of legal proof, and I shall now offer some reasons why it is simplistic. Legal proof does not rest on first personal belief or first personal epistemic acceptance. Verdict deliberation is not regulated only by the verdict rules. There are other decision rules. And the effect of other decision rules is to require the judgment on the accuser's guilt to be made from a third personal point of view, not the first personal point of view. First, there are rules on what the judge must not treat as evidence in deciding on the verdict. The judge may only take into account admissible evidence that has been admitted, presented at the trial. And this has several implications. One is the judge may not rely on his or her personal knowledge, of which no evidence has been adduced. Indeed, if the judge has any personal knowledge about the case, that would likely disqualify the person from acting as a judge. Another implication is that if the judge has somehow been wrongly exposed to evidence that's legally inadmissible, the judge must ignore those evidence during verdict deliberation. Secondly, there are rules on the sufficiency of evidence. Such rules are now, I think, relatively rare, at least in common law systems, because modern systems of legal adjudication pride themselves on free evaluation of evidential weight. One rare example would be a rule like Section 6 of the Sedition Act in Singapore. It provides that no person shall be convicted of the offence of sedition on the uncorroborated testimony of one witness. So in a sedition case, however reliable the testimony of that single witness may be, and even the judge is justified in believing the witness, the judge is not permitted to return a guilty verdict on that testimony alone. But notice that so far as the guilty verdict is concerned, Section 6 works as a negative constraint rather than a positive compulsion. By this I mean that Section 6 requires that there must be more than the testimony of one witness, but it does not compel the court to convict so long as there is some corroborating evidence. Thirdly, in relation to evidence that has been properly admitted and which the judge must consider in determining guilt, there are rules that constrain reasoning on evidence or the uses to which evidence may be put. Here are two illustrations. Under the common law rule of hearsay, evidence of an out-of-court statement may be used as a basis may not be used as a basis for inferring the truth of the fact asserted therein. So an out-of-court statement by X that the accused stabbed Y cannot be used as evidence of the fact that the accused stabbed Y. But evidence of an out-of-court statement may be used as a basis for drawing some other logically relevant inferences, as may be justified in the circumstances of the case. Thus, where the accused is relying on the defense of duress, evidence of the fact that someone had made a threat of harm, someone had threatened harm to the person, may be used as a basis for inferring that the accused was in fear. Second example, Rule 404B1 of the Federal Rules of Evidence in the United States. Evidence of other crime, wrong, or act is not admissible to prove the person's character in order to show that on a particular occasion, the person acted in accordance with the character. So the prohibition is on a line of reasoning. And a similar rule at common law exists, which forbids this so-called forbidden line of reasoning. The reasoning, once a thief, always a thief, is unsound and objectionable. And here, I've learned a lot from yesterday's presentation on stereotype. I learned that there's a lot that I don't know about it. So, but the law anyway is premised on the idea that this line of reasoning is objectionable and unsound as well. But the thing to note is that such evidence is not always inadmissible. It is admissible if, in the circumstances, it supports some other factual inferences on reasoning that is sound and unobjectionable. And if so, it is admissible for that purpose under Rule 404B2. For example, where the accused is charged with the offence of possessing insignia relating to a triad society and claims lack of knowledge that the items found in his possession were related to the particular triad society, the prosecution may adduce evidence of his previous conviction of membership of that triad society to prove that he had such knowledge. The inference of knowledge in these circumstances supposedly does not rest on the forbidden line of reasoning, and that's fine. In both examples, I think some sort of epistemic paternalism is at work. The hearsay inference is unreliable because it rests on the credibility of the maker of the statement, who cannot be tested in cross-examination. And reasoning from past misdeeds, past bad conduct, can be unsound, where it involves a sort of jumping to the conclusion of guilt from our perception of the kind of person the accused is. So I think the rules themselves can be evaluated in epistemic terms. But notice once again that the legal regulation of evidential reasoning is only by way of negative and narrowly defined constraints. Save for specifying some limited uses to which the evidence may not be put, the law in general does not compel the judge to draw any inference from the evidence. And one famous evidence scholar, Professor Thayer, famously put it, "The law has no mandamus to the logical faculty. The law orders nobody to draw inferences." So it seems to me that if the epistemic construction of legal proof is not to be simplistic, it must acknowledge the legal constraints of decision rules of the sorts that I've just mentioned. The judgment on the accuser's guilt must be made within those constraints and from a detached perspective. It is not the first personal belief that counts. What the judge must ask himself or herself is essentially, would one be justified in believing that the accused is guilty based on the evidence before the court and within the constraints of the applicable decision rules? And I am happy to leave it as an open question whether belief for present purposes should include or be replaced by epistemic acceptance of the kind or similar to the kind proposed by Professor Lehrer. The following formulations, I have in the handout, are not intended as precise definition, but I think they are a summary of what I've just discussed. So guilt is proved if and only if, I think it should be necessary and sufficient, based on the evidence before the court and within legal constraints, one would be justified in believing that the accused is guilty of that offence. And guilt for the charge of offence is disproved if and only if, based on the evidence before the court and within legal constraints, one would be justified in believing the accused is not guilty. Right, so that's quite a mouthful. So in what follows, I'll simply speak of proof as a matter of whether one would be justified in believing the accused to be guilty or not guilty. So the legal constraints that I've alluded to should be taken as tacit It is not enough to have the... How long has it gone? 5 minutes.
Yes.
If the morning
okay. I'm in trouble then. Oh dear.
Let's make it 10.
Okay. Right, so I'm so sorry about it. I'm so sorry. Anyway, it's not enough to have the two verdict rules.
5 minutes could mean 10 minutes.
Yeah.
I could mean half an hour. Suppose the evidence is such that one would neither be justified in believing the accused to be guilty, nor justified in believing the accused to be not guilty. In other words, guilt is neither proved nor disproved. And I've set up in my handout what this kind of scenario is. And under the circumstances, what is the judge to do? As I've said, there are only two options, either convict or acquit. So we need another rule to break the impasse. And that's why we have the third verdict rule. I'll not read out the third verdict rule, you can read out for yourself. And the third verdict rule is essentially the presumption of innocence. It is a rule of practical reasoning. As Professor Orman Margolit puts it, it's a way out when the judge is called upon to act in a state of ignorance or doubt. It's a rule of practical reasoning. Now, the presumption of innocence is against each element of the offence. So long as one element is neither proved nor disproved, the judge must acquit the person because the person has not committed, the commission of the offence has not been proved. Okay, so let me just quickly jump to a different rule, a conditional presumption that replaces the presumption of innocence. And one example is section 17. I'm not sure whether I did produce it in the handout.
Yeah.
You have? Okay. Right, so this is an actual example, but a similar provisions can be found in many legal systems. And section 17 essentially states that where any person is proved to have more than a specified quantity of controlled drug, for example, more than 2 grams of diamorphine, the person is presumed to have had that drug in possession for the purpose of trafficking, unless it is proved that the possession was not for that purpose. And the logical structure of this rule is, as I've set out in the handout, RP, upon proof of A, and unless B is disproved, judge must find that P. In the interest of time, let me just give an example. Suppose an accused person is charged for drug trafficking and the particular offence is possession of diamorphine. There's no dispute that he was in possession, that he knew what it was, and the only material fact that's disputed is whether the possession was for the purpose of trafficking. Now, suppose the prosecution fails to produce sufficient evidence to prove that the possession was for the purpose of trafficking. Right? However, the prosecution manages to prove that the substance found in him was more than 2 grams of diamorphine. And under section 17, now the accused has the burden of disproving the element number 3, element C. And if the accused succeeds in disproving that the possession was for the purpose of trafficking, he's acquitted. Why is he acquitted? Because of VR2, nothing to do with the third verdict rule. But suppose the accused person tries to rebut the presumption, but the evidence is too weak to disprove the presumptive fact. So on the evidence, one would not be justified in believing that the drug was for the accused's own consumption, for example, and the presumption that he or she possessed the drug for purpose of trafficking would now stand unrebutted. But at the same time, it's not proof that the possession was for trafficking. So, in other words, to cut a long story short, this is a situation where a necessary element of the offence, was the possession for the purpose of trafficking or not, has neither been proved nor disproved. And as such, one where it is neither proved nor disproved that he's guilty of that offence of drug trafficking. The presumption of innocence will require the person to be acquitted, but the effect of section 17 is that he must be convicted instead. So this is a situation where the accused would be declared guilty of an offence, not asserted, but declared guilty of an offence, in circumstances where it is neither proved nor disproved that he committed the offence. So this is one where the judge is neither justified in believing that he's guilty, nor justified in believing that he's not guilty. And I think this is problematic. It is problematic. I'm not sure how long I have to go. Go away. Is you okay? I can take my time. Okay. So why is it problematic? Well, it's problematic because the motivating reason for convicting the accused in our hypothetical cannot include the fact that the possession was for the purpose of trafficking. Element C, right, has not been proved. The judge has determined that the third element is not proved. The judge acknowledges that one would not be justified in believing that the possession was for the purpose of trafficking. Now, a person cannot act for the reason that P, or on the grounds that P, unless she stands in some epistemic relation to P. Right? So if the judge judges that based on evidence, one would not be justified in believing that the accused's possession of drug was for the purpose of trafficking, the judge cannot claim that as part of the reason for convicting the accused. So the reversal of the legal burden of proof is objectionable because it in effect allows or even require a criminal conviction to be motivated by a reason that falls short of the normative reason announced in the offence rule under which the person is convicted. So I then, in the later part of the paper, goes on to say how this kind of situation is actually a derogation from one aspect of the rule of law, and I relied on Lon Fuller on his idea that one aspect of the rule of law is consistency of legal rules, and this idea that there must be congruence between official action and declared rule. But I think, in the interest of time, let me just say that the problem, what we're facing here now, is a lack of congruence and incongruence between offence rules as announced to citizens and decision rules that guide judges in administering the offence rules. So, let me just conclude. So, should we convict persons we don't believe to be guilty? Well, it's complicated. I think, as I've said, judges do not determine criminal verdict by simply asking the first personal question. Do I believe the person is guilty or not? It's certainly not that simple. They're required to make a third personal judgment whether one would be justified in believing, based on certain, subject to certain constraint, that the accused is guilty as charged. If the judge concludes that one would not be justified in believing any fact necessary to constitute the accused's guilt for the charged offence, the judge cannot claim as his or her reason for convicting the accused that he or she has committed the charged offence. And the judge should not convict the accused in these circumstances because the judge's motivating reasons for doing so would fall short of the normative reason needed for the conviction. But exceptionally, the law does permit this lack of congruence that I've just mentioned. And this is unsettling because it undermines the rule of law. And that is why when courts are only prepared to uphold such a rule, the rule that reverses the legal burden, only when special justification is needed. I rushed a bit through the last part. I'm sorry about that. But am I okay?
Okay? Thank you. Okay, now we open the debate. Jordi, please.
Thank you so much, Hoklai. I really appreciate your presentation. Nevertheless, I have a doubt about what is the crucial question. Mm-hmm. For your interest. If the crucial question is if there is some kind of pragmatic incoherence in the situation in which the judge or the jury said John is guilty, but I don't believe it. Is there some pragmatic incoherence in this situation? In my opinion, the answer is obviously yes. Rains, but I don't believe it. It's a little bit problematic, impragmatic, impragmatical perspective. If this is the question, obviously, from the point of view of the reasons and of the argumentation of the judge is not justified in convicting the John if the judge itself said that I don't believe it. But another question, absolutely different, is if the guilty of John is justified. And this doesn't depend on the beliefs of the judge. My belief that, or my state of mind that I don't believe that it rains, is not at all a reason in favor or not that it rains. And in this sense, the conviction of John, it not depends on the belief of the judge. The justification of the conviction of John is absolutely independent of the believing of the judge. Let me read four lines. From the epistemological point of view, it is quite irrelevant whether my feeling of conviction was wrong or weak, was strong or weak, whether it came from a strong or even irresistible impression of indubitable certainty or self-evidence, or merely from doubtful surmise. None of this has any bearing of the question of how scientific statements can be justified. This is Popper, The Logic of Scientific Discovery. And I think there is no difference in the realm of legal decision. Then, which is your question? The question is that there is a pragmatic coherence or incoherence when a judge says John is guilty, but I don't believe it. If this is the question, okay, obviously there is an incoherence if the judge says that. Or the crucial question is, the justification of the conviction of John requires the belief of the judge in their guilty. If this is the question, my opinion is, like Popper, absolutely not. And this is the question. In your conclusion, the answer, it turns out, is complicated. In my opinion, it's not complicated. It requires only a process of disambiguation of the question.
Well, thank you very much. There's a lot to process. Actually a lot of points. So first, you suggested there's some sort of incoherence for the judge to say that John is guilty, but I don't believe that John is guilty. Now, what about to say that the verdict is not assertive? The verdict is merely declares John to be guilty, right? If that's the case, there is, strictly speaking, no incoherence. I declare John to be guilty, but I don't believe John to be guilty because, you know, the status of whether a person is guilty or not does not turn on belief, right? So we're assuming that the verdict is assertive, or at least the verdict claims that it is true that the accused is guilty. Then there will be some sort of incoherence, right? It is true that John is guilty, but I don't believe that John is guilty. Well, I suppose it would be quite irrational, perhaps, just to take that position. But I think the second point is a valid one. And there's a distinction between whether one is justified in holding a belief and whether the belief itself is justified. You're right. Whether a conviction itself is justified certainly depends on whether the accused is guilty or not, independent of whether anyone thinks it's guilty or not. So in that sense, it's factive in that sense. But the belief account can cater to that, because if you say that an assertion is based on belief, if you believe the accused to be guilty and believe the accused is innocent, then your belief is false. You have made an error, right? So in finding the accused guilty on the basis that the evidence justifies the belief the accused is guilty, that you believe the accused to be guilty and the evidence justifies it, there is an error there. You believe someone to be guilty, but the person isn't guilty. So in a way, truth does matter, even if you take an epistemic account. But another thing is, if you say a conviction is justified only if it is true that the accused is guilty, how do you tell whether the accused is guilty or not? You still need to mediate through some sort of epistemic channel, I think, right? So if, suppose I'm talking about a verdict rule. The verdict rule is a rule that's addressed to the judge, right? This is how you must decide whether to convict and acquit. And you tell the judge, convict if the person is guilty, acquit if the person is innocent. Well, how is the judge to implement that kind of rule? Right? The judge would have to implement that kind of rule according to, well, do I know whether the accused is guilty or not? And that means that epistemology does have a role here. But I'm trying to resist the idea that all this is just an epistemic problem. It's not just an epistemic problem. It is a much bigger problem than that. It is a problem that, it's a problem that addresses our interest in having the rule of law, in adhering to the rule of law. And that requires some sort of congruence between how officials decide the verdict and the normative justification for the verdict. If decision rules allow judges to convict persons for inadequate reasons, then that's not just an epistemic problem. Right? That is, I think, a practical problem. But I'm sure I've not addressed everything you've said. Probably need time to process it.
Okay. Professor Williamson?
Yeah, so this might be related. It's about principle P on page 3. So guilt for the charge of offence is proved if, based on the evidence before the court and within legal constraints, one would be justified in believing that the accused person is guilty of that offence. So when people talk about, being justified in believing something in theoretical context, they're usually thinking of that as a non-factive notion, so that you can be justified in believing something that is in fact false.
Yes.
But when they talk about proof, they're thinking of that as a factive notion. So the idea, so there seems, at least from a layperson's point of view, there's just a contradiction in saying that the person was... their guilt was proved, but it turned out that that in fact they were innocent. That's just a contradiction, because if they were innocent, then their guilt hadn't actually been proved. It had been, as it were, inverted commas proved, and the court had taken it to be proved. It seems like there's a problem, because in effect implies that proof is non-factive, assuming that you're using justified in believing in a non-factive way. And it seems like, of course you could say that this is a standard for taking guilt to have been proved, because you can. There's no contradiction in saying that guilt was reasonably taken to have been proved, because that's not a factive notion.
But
saying that it actually was proved, even though it turned out that the person was innocent, that seems like a contradiction.
Well, yeah, I think that's a very good point. Now, is proof factive?
Yes. Absolutely, definitely. You could tell me, well, I'm using it as a technical term, but if you're talking about the ordinary notion of proof, Yeah, you know, when you talk about something.
Well, it's the philosopher's notion of proof.
No, but it's a notion that's used all over the place. It's used in mathematics. Yeah. But of course that's a very high standard of proof. But it's also, you know, but I think if you just said to any ordinary person that somebody was proved to have been guilty. You know, that they would deduce from that the person was guilty. I mean, that's not just a conversation implicature. That's if they later found out that the person was innocent, then they would think that the original claim that they'd been proved guilty was false. So the normal notion of proof is factive. I mean, as I say, you can tell me that this is not. A normal use of the word proof that the word proof has been hijacked for some other meaning, but it just in terms of you know the normal notion it is a contradiction.
Mm. How would you solve that problem?
Well, I was saying that I mean, of course, I would do things in terms of knowledge, but just putting that aside. But if you want to. I mean, you were talking about implementation, and so you know. So if you were saying this was a standard for, as it were, for the judge to take.
It's not a standard of correctness for the verdict.
No, but it's
a standard to guide the judge.
Yes, but it's a standard. But then I think it would be better to put it in the form you should take guilt to have been proved, if blah blah blah. Because taking guilt to have, you know, and even properly taking, in some sense, I mean, kind of reasonably taking guilt to have been proved, that's not factive. But you need, as it were, some kind of, you know, intermediate, some buffer thing between the proved and the judge in order to block the factiveness that's built into proof.
I think that's very helpful. I think you're right. Well, thank you very much. I think you're right. I have to tweak this. Yeah. But I'll acknowledge you. Don't worry. Yeah. Okay. I think that must be right. Yeah. That must be right. Don't you think?
I think it differs from the way lawyers usually talk. I mean, well, there's a sector, or at least a group of, I think it's a big group, that even the law itself, it's this fact has been proven to an X standard. So implying that a standard of proof establishes a threshold for asserting as proven some proposition and understanding that threshold as something that may be first non-factive and variable.
Yeah, but that's putting an extra operator in this. The, you know, by standard X, it was proved that. And by standard X is not factive.
Mm. Okay. Professor Babise?
Yeah, this issue as well, just slightly different direction. So you were saying that you think that justified belief is sufficient for proving guilt, and so one issue is activity, but another issue, I can imagine a lot of cases where the evidence makes it very likely that somebody is guilty, and so one has plenty of justification for thinking that it's guilty, the person is guilty, but short of knowledge, it would be very we have to say that the guilt has been proved. So, just to think about concrete cases, and I don't know how you think about that, but you know, I can imagine cases where the evidence is very strong. That's somebody is the murderer. He's really accused one and. It seems that he doesn't have an alibi, and really, but perhaps they haven't found a weapon.
Okay.
Right? So in that case, I would say that the evidence clearly makes it very likely that the person is guilty. Perhaps he is guilty as well. I would say that like any reasonable standard, I'm justified in believing that the person is guilty. And you know, I think that many people could, like newspaper would be justified in saying, oh, this is the most likely candidate to be. But I would say also that the judge that wouldn't know that short of finding the weapon. So is that how you think? I mean, so what notion of justification is such that? That, I mean, it seems that it cannot entail knowledge for you, of course, because if it doesn't, so why wouldn't one be justified in that case?
I think one.
I'm just trying to find for an example that is kind of concrete, where it's kind of reasonable to think that you're justified, it's true,
right.
but it's short of knowledge. But other cases maybe, you know, like perhaps statistical evidence is another case where you have very high evidence that somebody is guilty, probabilistic evidence of some sort, but, you know, you still don't count as knowing, right? That's the analogous of lottery paradoxes. Or you can have even for more far-fetched cases, like ghetto cases, even without going with that, I'm just curious about what kind of notion of justification is in play here, such that I wouldn't be justified in that particular case, that was described.
Right. Well, I think you would be justified in believing the person to be guilty, and you would be justified in convicting the person. If you base your evidence.
I was in an assumption that if you don't find a weapon, you actually
don't. Don't find a weapon. Well, you don't need to find a weapon to convict a person of murder. That's possible. Yeah, that's possible. In that kind of scenario, so long as you base it on evidence that's actually produced in court, of course, there's reason why there's that rule in the interest of open justice and so forth. If you base it on evidence that's adduced at a trial, and you don't engage in any sort of forbidden reasoning that the law thinks is epistemically risky, then whether you're justified or not is epistemic justification. And if the evidence is strong enough to provide epistemic justification for the belief that the person is guilty, then you're justified in convicting. According to what I'm proposing.
Yeah, but I'm trying to understand what notion. So, how much evidence you need?
Oh, okay. Well, that is.
So,
right, yeah.
Other cases, like maybe the bodies, you haven't found the body, but you really have strong reasons that the person is dead and that person is murdered. Like, all that rules points in that direction. So you have plenty of wouldn't that be a case where you don't know? You haven't found the body, so you know.
Well, actually, you can convict a person without finding the body.
Also,
there's a famous case in Singapore where the body was never found.
Yes.
And based on other circumstances.
They did convict.
Yes, they did
convict.
Well, why shouldn't they? If the evidence is strong enough to justify the belief that the case did it, why should the law prevent conviction?
Okay,
well. You can destroy the body. That's the mother answer.
Finger?
Yes. I was wondering also what notion of epistemic justification are you using and what determines whether epistemic justification is enough. Probably you would say, well, the standard of proof in criminal law is beyond a reasonable doubt, but what does it amount to be enough, to have enough epistemic justification in order to satisfy beyond a reasonable doubt?
Right, well, that's a very difficult question, and I avoided it in the paper. I'm drawn to the relative alternative framework that Edgar mentioned in his presentation, because Jordi Gardiner has done done considerable work trying to set up that kind of framework, and it seems very attractive to me. But the problem, of course, is how to distinguish between proof beyond reasonable doubt and balance of probability. Are you to use the same framework? And if so, how do you make it one to be stronger than the other? I mean, of course, this is extraordinarily difficult.
Okay. I was looking for is something more about your second response about the three objections that you said,
Okay.
Problem,
right. Yes, thank you. Yes, yes, thank you very much. Yes, the notion that, you know, justification is relative to what is at stake. Again, there are philosophers working in that direction, and everything in philosophy is controversial. Obviously, you know, I can't defend, not that I'm able to, interest relative account of knowledge. That was quite foolhardy of me to try to do so. So I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to do it in this paper. And just noting the possibility. So when I use works of philosophy, I'm just borrowing. I'm not, well, because I'm not able to adjudicate between different philosophical views. I'm just trying to borrow ideas. And one of the ideas is this notion of interest relativity. You know, many philosophers in this room, I'm sure, have views on whether that's a good account of knowledge or not. I'm sure there's, I think, one is a strong view that it should not be relative to what is at stake. From his contribution earlier this morning, that's what I sense. I'm not a philosopher. I'm not a philosopher. So unfortunately, I can't really defend the thesis. I'm taking the easy way out.
Professor Comesania?
Thank you. My question is also about B on page 3, and maybe it's just an expression of another profound bafflement that I have about the legal system. So suppose that the... And this actually brings out a way in which I thought that, you know, objections 1 through 3 were relatively not interesting compared to this objection,
okay,
to whether we should convict when we don't believe that in guilt. So suppose that the final fact, so according to the evidence before the court, that proves to the right degree guilt, but the final fact has access to evidence not available to the court. I think that's true. I mean, other, if I were the judge in that case, I would definitely not give a verdict of guilty. I mean, you know, suppose the evidence you have access to is just decisive evidence of innocence. I guess, are there legal procedures in place to deal with situations like that? Should the judge recuse himself? Should it issue a guilty verdict and then go on to help the defense appeal, or what happens in those cases?
Well, I think your proper role would be as a witness, not
sorry?
As a... Your proper role would be as a witness, not as a judge.
Right, and so I should reduce myself.
Well, if you're a lay person, you would not be selected as a member of the jury because of your personal knowledge. And if you're a judge, you must recuse yourself.
But suppose selection already happened and I'm at the stage of issuing a verdict.
Well, that's naughty of you then.
What?
It's very naughty of you then, because you're sworn.
No, I didn't know before selection happened. So I just.
Well, jurors are supposed. Well, they're sworn to give a true verdict according to the evidence produced in court. That's the oath that the jury must take. You know?
Let's make it a judge. The judge.
Okay.
The case comes before him. And
then
there's nothing untoward.
Well,
the
there's a breach of judicial ethics if you stay on the case when you know something about the case.
So you should reduce yourself.
Yeah, I mean, you'll be breach of judicial ethics if we stay on, I think.
So the answer to the question is, no. Should we be convicting people with only to be guilty of this in that case? You should reduce yourself. You shouldn't be convicted.
You shouldn't be a judge.
Yeah, therefore you shouldn't be.
So you have no power to convict or acquit.
Right, but therefore, the answer is no.
The answer is no. The rule apply only to a judge.
Yeah, so I'm a judge. Comes the time to convict, I shouldn't. I should reduce myself.
Okay, yeah.
So I should not.
Yes, you can put it that way. Yeah. But you will not come to this stage. This stage arrives only after the trial is over, all the evidence has been reduced. So you would not come to this stage where you have to determine the verdict.
I mean, maybe I don't come to this stage. You know? Maybe it just happens right before I have to issue the verdict, you know, that I come across this evidence. Practicalities of when I have access to this evidence don't seem to me theoretically
important. Well, yeah, but I suppose in that kind of scenario, something has gone wrong, which has nothing to do with the verdict rules, right? the judge should have recused himself or herself. Okay. I mean, would you see this as a problem with the verdict rules? Or
yes.
With,
yes, were, most definitely. I see it as a problem with P.
P.
Yeah.
Okay. Sorry, can I just try to understand? So it's a problem because the judge has personal knowledge of certain facts about the case, and the law says you're not supposed to take that into account.
Yeah.
Okay. If that kind of scenario is in fact, does arise, I don't think it should arise, but if it does arise, then I think, yeah, the judge... That's an interesting question then. What should the judge do? Should the judge... You see, if the judge were to convict, the judge would not be following this rule, right?
Why not?
Well, because it's not basing the conclusion on evidence adduced at the trial, because that's one of the constraints.
So the evidence available to the court is sufficient to prove guilt to the required degree.
Oh, okay.
So what the judge has access to is evidence of innocence.
Oh. Oh, I see. Okay.
At the very last minute, the judge's wife texts him and says that she was sleeping with the accused at the time of the murder and gives the accused an alibi.
Right. Well, there should be a retrial then. No, there should be a retrial in that kind of situation. That's a tricky one. I'm not sure what the correct answer is, because the rules of procedure would say something has gone terribly wrong in the kind of scenario where the judge...
Taking a very straightforward look at the question in your title and say, well, B is... the answer should clearly be no.
Maybe there are confusion or mixing in practical interests of judge. Maybe I cannot find or make a judgment when I judge of my wife. But the question is only epistemic. Mm-hmm. It's only the believing of. There are not practical interests in the question. I believe in the guilt or I not believe in the guilt.
No. You're asking whether practical interests should be affected into
If there are practical interests, maybe you have rebuttal, or maybe I cannot judge that trial. But if only see the question is a question about epistemic interest or epistemic things.
I think that is what they sometimes call the private knowledge of the judge.
Yeah.
Not the official knowledge.
Yep.
What must they do with the private knowledge?
Right. Well, that depends on the rules of a particular jurisdiction, right? What kind of knowledge the judge can take into account? For example, I mean, the law allows judicial notice to be taken of facts without proof, and judicial notice can be taken of commonly known facts. So, for example, there's no need to prove that the sun set in the west and so forth, right? So certain facts don't require proof. The judge can take judicial notice because it's common knowledge. Right? But we're supposing nothing of that sort. We're supposing some very material fact that really has an impact on the case. In that kind of situation, again, I'm not sure that the rules of evidence would be able to provide the right answer. It would probably be other procedural rules to determine whether the judge should stand down or not. But so I don't have an answer. I shouldn't keep saying that, but I do not have an answer to how you should respond to that problem. My sense is that it's not really the problem that I am addressing in this paper. I could be wrong.
Jordi has a finger, and suggests after the meeting that we move on to allow other people to, and then we come back to this issue, okay?
Let me put the question in these terms. What counts as justification for John's conviction or acquittal, if the decision is appealed and reviewed for higher court? should the higher court judge inquire about the beliefs of the trier of fact in the first instance, or only about the how strongly the evidence supports John's guilt? This is the question. In my view, it's absolutely absurd that the higher court judge must to inquire about the beliefs of the first instant judge. This is the question, in my view.
I agree with you that the central question is whether the conviction is justified.
Yeah.
Right. But that is a question of whether to allow the appeal or to allow the review. How would this have a bearing on the verdict rules, I wonder? Mm-hmm. I mean, this is a rule that applies at the appeal stage, at the review stage. And these are decision rules that govern that stage of the legal proceedings.
Not only for the second stage, but also for the first instance. The question in the first instance is the guilty hypothesis justified by the evidence in this case? This is the question. The question is, it is not I believe I in the guilty of the defendant.
Well, could one
absolutely irrelevant from a point of view of justification, the beliefs of the trier of fact. But it's obviously incoherent from a pragmatic point of view to say John is guilty, but I don't believe it. This is absolutely another question.
Well,
okay, let's come back after, because we have several words on, I'm afraid we're not making. There's not going to be enough time for everyone. Andrei, please.
Do I respond?
Mark.
It's okay.
My friend keeps calling me Andrei.
Mark, sorry.
El error es mío.
I remember yesterday you told me your name was Mark, but then he called me. Okay, I might be confused.
Mark, now as
an Andrei. Yes, you can. Sorry, one thing, he wants to reply something.
It's all right.
Okay.
It's all right.
Yeah, okay. Whatever my name is,
yes.
Thanks for the talk. And I have an alternative interpretation of Section 17, and
okay.
I want to know what's your opinion about it. That at the beginning of the talk, you use the definition of drug trafficking, where A, B, and C are necessary and maybe sufficient for drug trafficking. And I think what Section 17 is doing, not that I agree with this law, but what it's doing is just changing the definition of drug trafficking, where now A and B are necessary and generally sufficient for drug trafficking, but not C. And then my thought would be that the judge could be justified in believing that the accused is guilty, because now being guilty just means that A and B are proven. So even if C is not proven, you can justify your belief that the accused is guilty, because A and B, in the case you proposed, have been proven or are not disputed.
Right.
And still there would be a presumption of innocence regarding A and B.
Okay.
It's just
right.
that the
right.
law changes what it means to
right.
be guilty of drug trafficking. Does that make sense? Or?
Well, it makes sense, but I'm not sure I agree with it. I think there's a difference between a conclusive presumption and the conditional presumption that I'm talking about. It's a rebuttable presumption of law. In the case of a conclusive presumption, it's another instance of legal fiction, where upon proof of A, B is conclusively taken to be the case. then in that case you are redefining the offense. Not in our case, I think, because if it's a rebuttable presumption of law, it is still the case that element C is part of what it means to engage in drug trafficking. It must be for the purpose of trafficking. You know? And if the defense can disprove that it was for that purpose, then he should be acquitted. Why should he be acquitted? Because he has not committed the offense. Right? So it seems to me that the definition remains what it was. That's my take. But I can see where you're coming from.
Yeah. No, I think you're right.
Okay. José Juan?
Thank you for your interesting and illuminating presentation. I have one question to refer to the first section, this question of two kinds of legal rules, because you said, rightly, in my view, that defenses, I mean justification and excuses, defenses are for Van Cohen decision rules, for Stephen substantive rules, and you distinguish offense rules and decision rules. But for you, defenses are offense rules or decision rules, because it's not the same. Because it's if legitimate defense is an offense rule, to me, I know that according to the law, I could defend myself for an aggression, for an external aggression, and justify it aggression, and justify it attack. But if it's a decision rule, and in Dan Cohen account, these rules are totally separated. This is the acoustic chamber. Mm-hmm. You remember acoustic chamber? This is the idea. Totally separated. Then I have no the possibility of legitimate defense. This is only for the judge. The judge could decide that I am not responsible for this fact. But to me, there is no justification. And this is different. And my question is for you, defenses are offense rules, or better decision rules.
Right. You're talking about the defenses, right? Defenses. And in the paper, I sort of confined the discussion just to offense rules. And I said, look, I'm going to set aside the defenses. So again, that's an easy way out. But your question is, where would I place defense rules? Is it a decision rule or is it a...
Yeah.
Well, for sure it's not an offense rule, right? Because it's a defense.
Yeah.
I'm inclined to follow Stephen's approach, which is to see defenses as affecting the scope of criminal liability. So to that extent, it is a norm of criminal liability, but it's not an offense rule, right? So norms of criminal liability will include offense rules, as well as defense rules, norms, right? Mm. So if, let's say, the person acted under duress, the person should be acquitted, right? Because a person is guilty only if the person committed the offence and does not, in fact, have an available defence. So that's how I think I would see it. So I'm not following strictly Dan Cohen's conception of conduct.
I've seen an exaggeration because this acoustic chamber is not possible.
It's a tall experiment.
The Rankin experiment.
Yes.
Totally.
Marco Segati.
Thank you. So, a relatively small question. Just, I wonder why don't you make more of your responses to the three objections in section 4. I mean, the idea that there's a distinction between acceptance and belief, and this idea of systemic acceptance as a mental state ordinarily based on positive evaluation of men. And it seems that some of the issues that come out after could be perhaps accounted by some way of playing with acceptance and belief. But I just didn't find, I mean, you discussed it at the very beginning, but then you didn't use it afterwards. perhaps what we are looking for is not justified in believing, but justified in accepting to believe, or something like that. And then perhaps that would help.
Accepting to believe?
I mean, justified in form in this metamental state based on a positive evaluation of belief. So, something of that sort. That the reasons for accepting in court cases are not only systemic reasons, but they have to do with other considerations. So, in that sense, we could show why it's not a requisite that the judge actually believes in innocence or in guilt, or something to that extent. I mean, the question is just what it doesn't come out after the distinction between acceptance and belief, and I wonder whether you have.
Right. Well, if open to the possibility that belief should include or be replaced by epistemic acceptance, but not by practical acceptance, because I don't think practical acceptance is sufficient for present purposes. There are some who think of conviction just as a matter of distribution of risk. But I'm not inclined to that view. If proof is a matter of whether the probabilities are strong enough based on the evidence, whether it satisfies a particular threshold based on the evidence, then the verdict can never be wrong, right? Because even if the person is innocent, it's true that the conditional probability crossed the threshold. But I think if you convict an innocent person, there is an error. And it is an error if you take the epistemic account, I think. But it's not easy to see where the error lies, if anything has gone wrong, if you take the probabilistic view. In other words, if proof is, a fact is proof, if the conditional probabilities based on the evidence exceed, say, 0.95, right? That is true whether or not the accused is guilty as charged, which might mean that the verdict can never be wrong. And that is a bit unsettling for me. But anyway, that is a debate that I don't enter into in this paper, although I tried to argue for it in a separate paper. I'm not sure that I've convinced anyone at all, but anyway, I'm not in favor of convicting based on probabilities, in the straightforward sense. But of course, I mean, probabilities obviously must have a role in verdict deliberation, but it's not just in the direct, naked statistical sense.
Now Jaime probably will reopen the debate, the previous debate.
Sorry. I think that the mental state, specifically the belief of the state of mind, or the mental state, doesn't justify. Doesn't. The state, only the state.
Right. Yes.
The content of the beliefs, it is that which has justifies. Not the state, that the content of the belief. I believe that P, which justifies, is P. But I cannot imagine possess a content if I don't have any attitude toward the content. How could hold an anaproposition or anacontent if I don't have any attitude toward that?
Okay.
The quote of Popper that Jordi read, I think only referred to the vision of a state, that feeling that be, but not the of the content of the state. That is the, what do you think about it?
I'm not familiar with Popper's theory of falsification. Again, I must acknowledge my limitation here. I've insufficient understanding of Popper's theory. So what exactly is the problem here? You say that it shouldn't rest on the mental state, at least not directly. And you're obviously right. I mean, it can't be that a verdict is justified just because I believe that the accused is guilty. That obviously is false, right? It can't be right. What should be required is that there must be justification for that belief. And it must be true that the belief is... the belief must be true, right? So there must be belief, justification, and there must be truth in order for the verdict to be correct. But of course, some would say, look, in addition, there must be something else. What if you convict the person, a guilty person, by luck? No, it doesn't count as knowledge. But I don't see what the problem is. We should be thanking our good fortune, I think, in that kind of situation. You know? So that is how I see it. So I'm not sure what the problem is, because I agree with you that it's not just the mental state that justifies the verdict. It can't be.
The beliefs of flat planet, yeah, maybe don't justify anything. Yeah. The beliefs, so the mental state,
yeah,
doesn't justify.
Stephen used to define
and the content too.
Yeah,
but
yeah,
I think that obviously the only justifies reasons. And if the only way to have reasons is have an attitude toward that reason.
Okay.
I cannot hold any reason if I don't have an attitude of that reason.
Okay.
Toward that reason.
Okay.
That is the point.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, that's fair. I agree with that, but would that sort of require me to tweak any part of the argument, I wonder?
No. It's only for the discussion.
Right.
Before. But
I think you're right. It has to be mediated through some sort of proposition attitude of some sort. Yeah.
I have a question. No one else. Okay.
I wonder if I should tweak it this way, that the verdict is justified not just when the fact finder believes the accused to be guilty, and is justified in believing the accused guilty. There must be a third condition that the accused is in fact guilty.
I'm very sympathetic to think that the verdict is correct when the judge knows that being.
Well, yeah.
I'm very thin.
Oh,
so if I know, it's true. No, it's fact.
Okay. So you take the knowledge.
Yeah.
Okay. But I mean, if you insert the third element that it must be true that accused is guilty, then proof is factive, right?
Proof is.
Isn't it?
Yeah. Factive.
Right. That would solve the problem without needing to introduce knowledge.
That's my idea.
It's not knowledge, but it's still factive, right?
My question relates to this.
Okay.
What does it mean that you have enough proof to convict, but you don't believe that the person is guilty? If you have real proof, you should believe that it's guilty.
Yes.
Maybe you are not sure whether this evidence proves the guilt, so you don't know, and now you have the legal obligation to convict given the amount of evidence that was produced in the process. Okay. On the other hand, you might be saying like, look, I have a hunch. It's not that I know that the person is not guilty. I have a hunch, because if I know that the person is not guilty, I cannot possibly interpret this proof as proof of guilt.
Yeah.
If you know it's not guilty because you know how to explain of the other elements that are against him. Because if not, how can you know that it's not guilty? In order to know it, you have to know it even with all this evidence against him. This is my problem with the question itself. What does it mean that you believe, you mean that, what does it mean exactly, the question? You believe it's just a hunch, or is what?
I think that probably a hunch is a hunch of belief. Well, I suppose, I suppose in one sense it is not a belief. I've a hunch that something's the case, but I don't believe that in fact it is the case. That's possible, right? No?
I don't know whether I have a hunch, I don't know.
We're talking about outright belief, not sort of credence or partial belief. So it seems to me that a hunch is not really a flat-out belief, if it's just a hunch. I don't. What do you think? I have no idea.
The thing is about the nature of proof. If it is proven beyond certain threshold that the person is guilty,
okay.
Maybe you should believe it.
Okay. Well,
if you don't believe it,
all right. Second.
Maybe it's because you have other information that makes you think, or even you know that the person is not guilty, then you should be able to explain how come we have all this evidence against this person if I know it's not guilty. So I shouldn't convict because I know that it's not guilty and I should be able to explain. If I cannot explain, then I really, in fact, I don't know that it's not guilty.
Well,
I think the question is difficult because it's maybe too vague and sometimes it can be interpreted that, look, I have all this evidence, but I know it's not guilty. I have all this evidence, but I believe, I have a hunch that maybe the evidence is misleading or whatever. This is a different question and these have different treatments.
Yeah. Well, it's not just a matter of whether the fact finder, the judge, believes upright that the accused is guilty or not. That in itself, I mean, as you said, you know, it's not really what matters. In addition, it must be justified, right? The belief must be justified, and the belief must be true. Now, you mentioned this idea that, you know, so long as the probabilities crosses a particular threshold, why shouldn't that be enough? I mean, if the probability is high enough, why am I not justified in believing upright that you know, something's the case, right? I think the philosophers call it the Lockean view or whatever. And a lot of debate about whether that view is sound or whatever.
Well, you'll end up with inconsistent beliefs if you follow that rule in lottery cases.
But there are those who think that, you know, this is an acceptable view, you know. So I can't really can't really judge between, I mean, philosophers. Everything is controversial in philosophy.
Even that claim.
What I can say is that there are those who think that is not sufficient to count as outright belief. So it would not be enough on this particular proposal. As I've said, I'm not inclined towards the probabilistic view, but it is a view that many evidence scholars take. I don't think it's. I mean, you can have reasonable differences of view, but I'm just not inclined. For the reasons I've mentioned, if you take that view, then it seems that there can never be a wrong verdict, so long as the probability crosses the threshold. And there are some who argue that so long as you have a fair trial, so what if you're innocent, no wrong has been done, you have your say in court and so forth. And I find that rather troubling.
But you can misjudge probabilities.
Of course.
And then, if the standard was probabilistic, you could still be wrong, but because the probabilities had been misjudged.
Yeah, but if let's say you're correct, right? You're correct in assessment of probabilities. Can you ever be wrong?
Well, not
on a verdict. On a verdict. Right?
Well, I mean, of course, I think you can, but I mean, it's not that making the standard of correctness. That being a certain probability means that you can't be wrong about whether the standard has been met.
Right, of course, yeah, I agree with that, But would you be inclined towards the probabilistic view?
I wouldn't be.
You wouldn't be. I share your... but the problem is how do you argue against it? Because it's a widely held view. You know, a lot of evidence scholars take that view.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.